When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Maddie, I was walking down the street the other day, and I met someone that knows you from, I don't know, from your past, maybe. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. But they were, you know, I was saying, yeah, I know Matt. And they were saying that they, you know, they know you as well. And they said that you're a 10. They said, Maddie, that guy, he's a 10. And,
looks,
and I
went, looks.
Really? Well, I queried them further. I said, what do you mean a 10? And they said, 10 on the pH scale, because that boy basic. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mark's Medical Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about, you could probably tell from my joke at the beginning, acid and base, and so the physiology of acid and base.
So, is that the scale?
The pH scale.
Oh,
little pH. P, big H.
pH, sorry.
That's right. And we're going to talk about that today. But before we get started, let's talk about some housekeeping. If you want to ask us any questions, if there's any topics you want us to cover for you, please send us an email, gubiosciences@gmail.com, or you can just contact us on Twitter, which is gubiosciences, that's the Twitter handle, also on Instagram, gubiosciences as well. Feel free to contact us, ask us any questions or whatever.
Topics. Correct, Michael.
Yeah, I'm always wrong. Matt's more wrong than I am. So basically, you listen to a podcast that's just filled with mistakes. All right. Today, acid base balance, what an acid is, what a base is, and physiologically why it's important, and then some conditions. And then our next podcast will most likely be on ABGs, which is arterial blood gases, which will obviously...
Like the clinical test to...
Clinical test.
See what's gone wrong.
So, shall we start off with defining...
A few things. Mm-hmm.
All right. Should we first define pH?
I think start with an acid.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. First thing is everyone needs to be aware of hydrogen ions. Now, remember, an ion is a charged atom or element. And as a lot of you are probably aware, when you look inside of the fluids of your body, you've got intracellular compartments, which is inside the cell, mm-hmm. extracellular compartments outside the cell and in the blood.
Yep.
And if you were to take a sample of a patient's blood, so their plasma, you can actually have a look at the various concentrations of charged atoms and elements. What are some examples of these charged atoms or elements?
So, are these electrolytes?
These are electrolytes.
Right. So, this is what you have in your bottle of Gatorade.
And I was going to... So, an electrolyte is basically a salt. What it is it's a molecule that when placed into water, it disassociates into ions. That's what an electrolyte is.
So it gets a charge.
So what are these charged?
Does that mean it's neutral beforehand and then it becomes charged?
All right, let me give an example. You're right. Salt. Normal table salt, which we know is sodium chloride, NaCl. See how there's no positive or negative there?
Mm-hmm.
Because the chloride's negatively charged, the sodium's positively charged, together they balance each other out. Yet when you put salt in water, they disassociate and you get sodium ion, which is Na+, mm-hmm. and chloride ion, which is Cl-. Wonderful. So basically, our blood and our fluids are filled with these types of salts.
Okay.
So apart from sodium and chloride, what are some other examples, Matty?
Potassium.
Potassium. Yeah, that's K.
K
plus.
Okay. Yeah. So it's if it's a cation.
Yep.
It's a plus charge. So
do you know how to remember that? This is how I tell my students how to remember cation versus anion. If you like cats...
Cats are always positive?
Maybe. Well, if you like cats, that's a positive.
Is it?
I'm allergic to cats, so I hate it. So in actual fact, it's really difficult for me to remember. But cations, positively charged.
Why do you hate cats?
I'm allergic to them. I don't hate
what
them.
What happens to you?
I puff up.
Okay.
Breathing becomes difficult.
All right.
And I asphyxiate.
Maybe we can add that later to
I
what...
collapse onto the floor holding my throat.
Okay, that's enough. That's enough.
Okay, okay.
All right, so I usually remember it by cations has a T in it, which is like a plus sign.
No, it's not.
That's how I do it.
It's more like a cross.
All right, cross T, plus.
All right, so other cations within the body.
Oh, sorry. So we've got sodium is probably the most abundant.
Most abundant outside the cell.
Okay, we've got potassium, which is the most abundant in the cell. Is
yep.
that right? We've also got calcium.
Yep.
Which is...
mainly outside the cell. Magnesium. So calcium Ca2+, magnesium is Mg2+, mm-hmm. Some negatively charged, so some
chloride.
Anions, chloride, Cl-.
Okay,
and bicarbonate,
HCl3-.
They're the major ones, that's right. So, okay, so my whole point was we're trying to define an acid and base, and so I had to bring up these first, because when you take a patient's blood, you can measure the concentration of these things. And everything needs to be in homeostasis, which is a nice, happy, healthy range. So we never want one value of anything. It's always between a particular range. So for sodium, for example, do you know what the range of sodium should be in your blood?
Well, let's just pause for 1 second. And acid is just referring to hydrogen, right?
I'm going to get to that.
Okay. But before we get to the ranges, are we fair by saying an acid is a substance that donates the hydrogen?
It's going to get to that too.
Oh, sorry, my bad.
There's a whole setup that I'm working through.
Okay.
So you just got to trust me.
I couldn't see your brain ticking over. All right, so what was your question? Sodium in water?
What's the sodium concentration
In your blood. So if I took a vial of blood out and they did the biochemistry on it, it would come back, if it was in normal range, approximately 135 to 145 millimolar per liter.
Millimole. So you don't have to say per liter if you say millimolar, but you can say millimoles per liter.
Can't you have like deciliters?
Say that again.
Can't you also get
what?
Per 100 mils? Isn't there some measurements per 100
deciliter?
Mils?
Yeah. Yeah. So yep. So you can have deciliters or millimoles per liter. But if you say millimolar, that is per liter.
Oh, right. So millimole.
Yeah. So, or you could say milliequivalents. Now, basically, what we're referring to when we say molar is it's basically a concentration. And at the moment, you probably don't really need to be aware of what that concentration means. It's how many moles per liter of a solution. And 1 mole is what we call Avogadro's number, which is 6.022 times 10 to the 23 atoms.
I thought it was just an animal. Like a mammal.
It is. Like the naked mole rat, which is your spirit animal, isn't it?
That was my nickname.
The naked mole rat. So the concentration of sodium inside blood, your blood plasma is 135 to 145 millimolar. Okay?
All right.
All right. So what's the concentration of potassium, for example, in your blood plasma?
So this is outside the cells?
This is outside the cells.
3.5 to 5 millimolar.
Okay. Now, hydrogen ions, which again is just another ion, just like sodium, just like potassium, hydrogen ions, when you measure that, do you know what the concentration of that is in your blood?
Ooh.
It's a very, very small number. If you compare it to 145 for sodium and 4, for example, millimoles for potassium, hydrogen ion concentration is 0.00004 millimoles.
How many zeros?
Millimolar. That's 4 zeros and then a 4. That's millimoles per liter. That's the hydrogen ion concentration inside your blood. That number's too small. Where do we get these hydrogen ions from? This is where we go back to what you were saying. Acids. Acids produce hydrogen ions. So acids.
So instead of just are electrolytes. Just to clarify, so sodium's 140 millimole.
Yep.
So what would hydrogen be if you weren't going to use milli? Could you use another?
Yeah, so okay. So we need to be aware that when we do calculations and we start off with molar, that's a big number. A molar is a concentration, and then something can be millimolar, and then something can be micromolar, and then something can be nanomolar.
Right.
And what's the difference? Well, if I had 1 molar of something and I wanted to find out what it was in millimoles, millimolar, then it's 1,000 times different. So you're going to move that decimal place three places.
Three.
So 1 molar is going to be 1,000 millimolars. I've just moved the decimal place to the right
three places.
So now I've got 3 zeros there. Mm-hmm. If I want to find out what 1,000 millimolars is with micromolar, because it's even smaller, well, there's going to be more of them there. You move it another 3 decimal places. So you have...
Six.
1 million. Okay. So you now have 1 million micromolar. And you can keep moving it that way. You can go in the opposite direction too.
And so then you go to nano, which is 9.
9 zeros.
And so then you'd be... If you wanted to be accurate, you could say that the concentration of hydrogen ions is, let's say, ballpark 40 nanomolar.
That's right. You reckon we've confused people yet?
Yeah, probably.
All right. Back to basics. Back to basics is this. If I measure in a patient's blood 140 millimolar of sodium ions in the blood serum, that's millimolar. We can play around with that and we can express it as molar, right? Or we could express it as micromolar or nanomolar. You just got to change the decimal places. So if I've got 140 millimolar and I want to find out what it is in molar, well, molar is a larger measure of units. So you'll move the decimal place to the left
three places.
1, 2, 3, which means the sodium ion concentration in the blood plasma is 0.14 molar.
Okay.
And you can move in the opposite direction, which means you'll have 140,000 micromolar concentration. It's all the same thing. It's all the same thing. You just use in different units of measurement. Yep. It may be boring. It may be quite difficult to get your head wrapped around, but it's really important clinically, especially with hydrogen ion concentration.
All right. So we've got a pretty well-established sodium concentration that we'll use in our blood charts.
Yep.
And potassium.
Yep.
But now you've given me this very minuscule hydrogen number.
Yes.
Which is got 7 zeros after the decimal place.
Yep.
4. That's that right?
Yep. If you're measuring it in molar.
Yeah.
So, right. Yep. So,
and so that, you're not going to write that on a chart.
No.
So how would you change that to make it a bit easier?
Okay. Easy. So like Matt said, you don't want to write on a chart next to 145 millimolar of sodium and 4 millimolar of potassium. You don't want to write 0.00004 millimolar of hydrogen ion because it's ridiculous. Plus, you're going to lose count of the zeros.
Yep.
And if you lose count of 1 zero, patient will be dead. Right? So, we don't express hydrogen ion in the same concentration units that we express all the other ions.
Okay.
We express it as pH. And this is how you get to millimolar, or this is how you get to pH from millimolar.
All right.
So if you write out the hydrogen ion concentration is equal to 0.00004 millimolar, what you can actually do is, because there's so many zeros, we need to get rid of those zeros. And the way we get rid of those zeros is a calculation which is called log. Now, the log of something is to the power of 10, which means the log of 10 is 1 because there's 1 zero there. The log of 100 is 2 because there's 2 zeros there. Log of 3 and 1,000 is 3. Does that make sense?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, so if I were to log 0.0004 millimolar, what I'd end up getting is a number which is -7.4. Okay, that's just if you put it in your calculator. Don't stress out really about what that truly means. But all the log does is it calculates how many zeros there are.
Right, okay.
Now, if we were to calculate it from molar, there's 7 zeros and a 4. Hence, and because you're moving in the backwards direction to calculate it, it's -7.4.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Now I've got the log of hydrogen ions is -7.4. You don't want to write that down either. You don't want to have to write on a chart, log hydrogen ions equals -7.4.
Right.
We've got to get rid of that negative because it doesn't mean much.
Yep.
So then you do the negative log of it.
Okay.
So if you do the negative log, then you get rid of the negative.
And you get 7.4.
And you get 7.4. But you don't want to write negative log of hydrogen ions because, again, that's ridiculous. The negative log can also be written as the power of something. So negative log is equivalent to the power to something. So the power of hydrogen ions is 7.4. The shorthand of power of hydrogen ions could be written as pH.
So that's how you get the 7.4. pH. So it's not Fe.
It's not Fe. It's a little P meaning power and a big H for hydrogen ions, and it's 7.4. And it's telling you that there's 7 zeros and then a 4 in the negative direction. And that's the concentration in molar of hydrogen ions.
All right.
Is that confusing enough?
I think half of the listeners are asleep.
Yeah.
And we've just got a whole lot of chemists doing chemistry majors listening now. All right, so that's... And so the hydrogen can also be called sometimes protons, right?
Yeah, they're synonymous with each other.
Okay. All right, so we've now established that the pH in, let's say, the normal physiological body fluid, extracellular body fluid, should be around the range of 7.35 to 7.45.
Really important.
Okay, so that is the pH range, and we've figured out that there's a small amount of hydrogen in the body or in the fluid in comparison to a lot of the other electrolytes or other cation anions. Why is it so small? Why is hydrogen number so small? Is there a reason?
No idea.
Well, it's a very reactionary cation.
Ah.
So it can cause quite, not destructive, but in terms of chemical reactions, quite dramatic things, particularly... the way it associates with anions, and probably one of the most abundant type of anions in the body, proteins.
Ah.
And so if you've got hydrogens or hydrogen ions building up in the body, therefore there's more of them, and they're going to jump on board to certain things that are trying to soak them up.
So okay. We should, yeah, absolutely.
So if, you know how you spoke earlier about neutral?
Mm.
So I guess if there's other things in the body that have a negative charge, like proteins, the plus of the hydrogen can jump on the negative of those, and it can cause a change in the nature of those proteins, which is sometimes what we call a denature.
Perfect.
And if the proteins aren't working, then we've got some big problems.
Perfect.
But before we talk about the importance of regulating that pH of 7.35 to 4.5, let's just quickly make sure we've defined all the terms well enough.
Yep.
So we've said an acid is a substance that can donate hydrogen into the solution.
Correct, such as hydrochloric acid.
Okay, so that's HCl.
It has no charge until it's dissolved in water, and then it disassociates into the hydrogen ion, which is H+, and the chloride ion, which is Cl negative.
And is that the base or the conjugate base?
It's the conjugate base.
Yeah, okay.
Because the definition of a base is something that mops up hydrogen ions.
Okay.
So, simple. Acids release hydrogen ions. Bases mop them up. They like to hug them and never let them go.
Okay. So, a base then, the definition would be then the opposite. So, it's something in a solution that could...
Mops them up, like I just said.
Or accept it.
Yeah.
And that could be, again, going back to... You could say hydrogen ions or you could say protons.
Yeah, whichever.
Is that right?
Yeah, whichever.
Okay. Now... Michael, please give us a definition of what a buffer is.
Okay. A buffer basically resists drastic changes in pH change. So what a buffer does, so you can have a chemical buffer or a physiological buffer or whatever it may be, a buffer is something that when the pH begins to change, and this may mean that something happens in the body where we start to accumulate hydrogen ions, or something happens in the body where we have not enough hydrogen ions, the body needs to stay within that 7.35 to 7.45 pH.
Okay.
So, what we didn't say to listeners is that the pH scale goes from 0 to 14.
Okay. So and 0?
0 is the most acidic, which means it has the highest amount of hydrogen ions.
Okay.
And 14 is the most basic and has the least amount of hydrogen ions.
And so because it's a log scale, does that mean every time that you... And it's a negative log, right?
Correct.
So as you go to a smaller number,
yep.
because it's negative, it's actually coming closer to a whole number. Is that right?
Perfect. So what you need to do is if you were to write out 0 to 14 on a line, right? And you were to go to 7, pH 7, which is right in the middle.
Just
which we call,
I'm just writing it on your wall.
Okay. Oh, you could have used the whiteboard, but that's all right. So pH 7, which is neutral, okay? If you have a look at that and you were to write out how many hydrogen ions there are, or the concentration mm-hmm. in molar,
mm-hmm.
well, because like you said, it's a log scale, so it's to the power of 10, and it's a pH 7, so there's 7 zeros. But because you said it's in the negative direction... It's 7 zeros behind the decimal point.
Okay.
So it's 0.0000001.
Okay,
so that's it. That's what it is. That's the molar of hydrogen ions at pH 7.
All right. Because this is important because I find a lot of my students do get this confused when you talk about an acid, something that becomes more acidic.
Mm.
They sometimes think that the number should get bigger.
Correct.
But it's actually getting smaller.
No, number is getting
okay,
bigger.
But in terms of the number and the pH.
Yeah,
okay,
the number on the pH
it
scale
appears
is getting smaller,
to be going lower. So you might,
it's inverse.
Let's say in your stomach you got a pH of 1 or 2 and you'd think, some students think, oh, that's not a very big number, but actually there's a lot more hydrogen there than there would be at, say, 9.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So,
in actual fact, if you go from pH 7 to pH 6,
okay,
we know we're going to a lower number, but it's more acidic,
yeah,
which means we have a higher amount of hydrogen ions.
Right.
And in actual fact, you have 10 times more hydrogen ions at a pH 6 than you do a pH 7.
Right. So, if you had a pH 7 and you jump to 6, it at first glance, it appears that it's... you're losing a number by 1, but in fact, you're gaining 10 times more hydrogen.
That's right. So every time you go, basically, every time you move one spot on the pH scale, you're changing the hydrogen ion concentration times 10.
Okay.
So a pH 7 to a pH 6, you've got 10 times more hydrogen ions.
In
pH 6 to a pH 5, 10 times more hydrogen ions.
Mm.
pH 5 to a pH 4, 10 times more hydrogen ions. And then you go the opposite direction. Until you hit a pH 0, right?
Yeah.
What you then have is 1 molar concentration of hydrogen ions.
Okay.
Then you go to a pH 2, you got 0.1 molar hydrogen ions.
Okay, great.
pH 3, 0.01 molar. See how the number's getting smaller even though the number on the pH scale is getting bigger.
Mm.
Until you get all the way to 14, a pH 14, this is the concentration in molar of hydrogen ions. It's 0.00000000001 molar. Small number, right?
Well, I guess so.
Yeah, well, yeah, it is. Small number.
So,
have we got that point across, you reckon?
I think so. I think it's... Well, it's clear to me.
Yeah, well, if it's clear to you, then everyone else will get it.
Because I'm basic, right?
You are basic.
So, in front of Michael is a bottle of water.
Yeah, tell him it's water.
So... Sorry?
Nothing. Go on.
So, it's a bottle of water.
Yeah.
Let's just say there's nothing in it besides H2O. Can we assume that?
Yeah.
Now, if I get...
We can assume that.
So, all right. So, if I get an acid like HCl...
Yeah.
And actually, stop.
Hammer time.
If I put a pH meter in that bottle of water...
Yeah.
Let's assume it's deionized. So, what would the water's pH be?
7.
Okay, 7.
Neutral.
Fairly neutral.
Why is water neutral?
Is this just a deep philosophical question?
No, it's not. It's actually a chemistry-based question. If you write out water...
H2O. Hydrogen, and which are 2, and 1 oxygen.
Wow. Well, it looks like Matt finished grade 8. So, if you write that out... if you actually write out the oxygen, so write a 0, and then put 2 little arms coming off the O, not a 0, the O, and then one of them goes to 1H, the other goes to another H, and make it look like a boomerang, that's what water looks like as a molecule. 2 H's and an O.
So oxygen's essentially a strain then? Oh, yeah. Sorry, water is a strain.
Basically.
Because it's a boomerang.
Yeah.
Wow.
If you want to be a nationalist. So, the hydrogen ion... Those two hydrogen ions have partial positive charges, and the oxygen has partial negative charges. Now, what that means is, what you'll find is that water, the negative O, is going to attract other hydrogen ions from other water molecules.
Okay.
And the positive H's are going to attract other oxygen from other water molecules. And they basically...
just join each other.
They bind each other up. So you've got this equal amount of hydrogen being released and being attracted and being released and being attracted.
And that gives you the kind of the state of water?
It gives you the state of water.
So whether it's vapor, whether it's a solid, whether it's a fluid.
Yep. And if you... So basically right.
All right. So back to your water... Mm-hmm. I don't know. You got your chemistry hat on today.
Yeah, well,
just want to ask a simple question, and you go.
One of us needs to be an intellect.
So I put a pH mean in your water, which you're now drinking, and the pH is 7. Is 7?
Yeah, it's correct? About 7. Yeah.
All right. Now,
in actual fact, if you want to look at the pH of pure distilled water, it's going to be about 6.88. But that doesn't matter, Matthew.
All right. So I get out my vial of HCl,
hydrochloric acid,
and then I put a drop into it.
So you're basically trying to poison me.
Yeah. So the hydrogen chloride, HCl goes into the water.
Yeah.
And immediately kind of hits the water, it will dissociate. Hydrogen ions will go into the one side and the chloride will kind of go into another area.
Yeah. Is that fair? It's all together, but it's disassociating. Yeah. You got the hydrogen ion.
And so if I've got
chloride.
The pH meter still there,
yeah.
What I'll see is quite a rapid drop in the pH.
Correct.
So it's becoming closer to zero.
Yeah.
That's a big problem. All right. Yeah. Now, one of my favorite physiological professors, he stated...
Me? Is it me?
No. Okay. He stated that there was an experiment done like this, but I think they compared it to the water, to dogs. So, what they did was they got an acid, and obviously this was done back in the day when there wasn't much animal ethics.
Yeah.
And they just injected it into the dog.
Whoa. They injected hydrochloric acid into a dog.
I'm not sure what the acid is, but they injected some kind of acid.
Regardless,
straight into the dog's blood, I guess.
Okay.
And then maybe somewhere else in the dog, they took the blood out.
Mm.
And as they injected the acid at the same proportion as they put it in the bottle of water or the container of water, they noticed that the pH in the dog didn't change as dramatically as the bottle of water.
So they had a hypothesis in which we know how much the pH would change in water of the same volume, but we're going to put it into blood within an animal of the same volume, and it didn't change as drastically.
No.
Okay.
So when the container of water got down to, let's say, 1 in the dog...
pH of 1.
Yeah, pH 1. Mm. In the dog, it was like 7.3.
Wow.
So, it took a lot before it changed.
So, a dog's buffers.
Yeah. So, they then found, and again, I'm not sure when this was, probably...
Sounds like the 50s.
Probably before that. Anyway, they found that there's something in the biological system to stop this drastic change. And this is where the idea of a buffering system came about.
And a buffering system basically, like we said, resists drastic changes to pH, but they can do it in either direction. So they can absorb or mop up hydrogen ions if there's too many, and they can release hydrogen ions if there's not enough.
Yep.
That's basically the premise, right?
Yep.
And there's many different types of these buffering systems throughout the body.
Hmm.
Yeah?
So it's kind of like...
Why do we need them first? So like
it's kind of like, use another analogy from the same professor, he said it's kind of like... his father, let's say, when he was starting to earn money, his father was a buffer for his economy. So when he earned the money and got his paycheck at the end of the week, his dad took some money off him and kept it to himself, so he wouldn't spend it all, which seemed a bit mean.
Yeah.
But when he was on holidays and didn't work for a couple of weeks, his father then gave him back some money, and so he was
a financial buffer.
Financial buffer. Okay. So to resist too much drastic change.
Well, there you go.
Makes sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right. So, why do we need this?
Yeah. So, I think... why are we talking about it for hydrogen ions, but we're not talking about buffers for sodium ions or potassium ions? Why do we need buffers for hydrogen ions specifically?
Well, I think we said earlier that hydrogen ions or protons are very reactive in the fluids.
Mm.
And they can be very devastating.
Yeah.
To anions, particularly, as we said, protons, because I think in many cases proteins have a negative charge associated with them, and therefore, like we said, the proteins will be soaking up those hydrogens, and that's going to change the intrinsic structure, nature of the proteins.
So basically, hydrogen ions, you know, you look at the periodic table, you got hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, you keep going through, and they're in their neutral form in the periodic table. But what you're going to find is physiologically, or often within the environment, they're not always in this neutral form. Hydrogen, when it's within the body, within a solution, is often H+,
okay,
which means it's deficient of an electron. And it wants to be happy, it wants to be healthy, it wants to be whole, and to be whole, it needs to get that electron to be neutral again.
Okay.
So it will do anything it possibly can to get that electron. Where can it get electrons from? Well, it can go scavenging throughout the body, and it can pull electrons off our cells, destroy cell walls, start binding to proteins and finding other chemicals to pull these electrons off. It can share electrons with other atoms or elements within the body. And so, like you said, it's highly reactive in this way.
Okay.
And so the body needs to sort of mitigate this process, because if this happens too much, then, like you said, it's gonna start pulling these electrons off proteins. And yep, proteins do pretty much everything in the body.
Yeah, right.
And
can
so,
you give me some examples of important
proteins? So proteins are enzymes, for example.
All right. So
enzymes help us increase the speed of certain reactions,
right,
and help these reactions take place.
Okay.
Now, these enzymes will only function within the pH, well, depending on where we're looking at,
right,
within the
yeah,
body,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
will only function at a pH between 7.35, 7.45.
Mm-hmm.
If you start kicking that out of whack by having too many hydrogen ions, for example,
right,
then it's going to start changing the morphology of these proteins.
Right.
They're going to... Now, when you look at a protein...
Yep.
A protein is this three-dimensional shape, and like you've said previously, you're going to have certain side chains of these proteins. So some proteins are going to be negatively charged, some will be positively charged.
So proteins are made up of amino acids.
Yeah.
They're the building block of a protein.
Yeah.
So little bricks, you know, thousands and millions of amino acids will form a protein.
Mm-hmm.
And together...
Thousands.
Okay.
Hundreds,
yeah,
to thousands.
I got... a bit excited.
Tens to hundreds to thousands.
All right. So you've got all these little bricks of amino acids,
yep,
at different orders that then create the house of a protein.
And all these amino acids have different personalities and characteristics.
Yeah. And so depending on how they're arranged would ultimately depend on the 3D structure of the protein, right?
So can I give an example?
Yeah,
just
sure,
quickly. So let's say we take five amino acids, and let's say one likes water, one hates water, one is very negatively charged, one is very positively charged, and the other one is very negatively charged.
Or neutral.
Or neutral. What's going to happen is when they click together, they're going to now form a three-dimensional conformation or a three-dimensional shape which best suits their properties.
Yep.
So the one that hates water is going to be embedded deep within the protein.
Okay.
The one that likes water is going to be on the outside of the protein. Mm. The one that's negatively charged wants to go towards the one that's positively charged, and one that's neutral probably doesn't care where it's located.
Yeah, right.
And then what you get at the end of the day is this, without any influence by us or whoever or whatever, nothing is actually telling it to go into its three-dimensional shape, but its intrinsic characteristics.
Yeah.
But the problem is, but this happens within an environment of 7.35, 7.45 pH.
Yeah, yeah.
If you change that pH, you can change the characteristics and properties,
yeah,
of those amino acids. So if you start changing the pH, something that was originally negative may now,
yeah,
be positive, and now
or neutral.
Or neutral.
Yeah, because it soaks up that hydrogen.
Exactly. And
yeah,
so now,
yeah,
it may not be on the outside of the protein, maybe on the inside, which then changes its function.
And that could turn it off.
It could, right, turn it off.
Yeah, and that's called generally denaturing the protein.
That's right.
And so another example of how that happens is heat or temperature.
It's actually synonymous. Temperature,
yeah,
and acid changes, you get the same effect on proteins.
Yeah. And you can see that as an example when you have an egg.
Yes.
An egg has maybe a more fatty or cholesterol yolk. And then the white or the clear part is albumin, which is a heap of protein.
Mm.
And if you, as you know, if you break it and put it on a hot plate, that white or that clear goes white, which is now denatured. Same thing would happen, right? If you put it in a
vinegar.
Acid.
Yeah, acid. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Now, and so you have enzymes or proteins in your body that allow you to carry out a whole array of processes to,
yeah,
keep you alive.
Yeah.
Keeping pumps going, keeps metabolism going. And a good thought of that is think about reptiles.
Yeah.
If you put a reptile in a cold room, it won't move. It will just stay curled up or just,
yeah,
stationary. but then it moves out in the sun. It heats up. Proteins go towards their pH, or sorry, their temperature that they'd like to work at.
And then they start metabolism to starts to kick in. Yeah. So if we look at the hydrogen ion concentration within the body, in the blood, it has to be 7.35, 7.45. That's the blood. But different parts of the body have different hydrogen ion concentrations. Huge range differences. Like, we know that the stomach produces huge amounts of hydrogen ions, and that's through something called proton pumps. Now, if a proton pump is working, it's pumping out heaps of hydrogen ions into the stomach. If it's not working...
Where the food is.
And the whole point there is to denature proteins to make digestion easier.
So they're the proteins that you just ingested.
That's right. Mm. So that's what the hydrogen ions, the acid that the stomach's releasing to have the hydrogen ions present, denatures proteins. It doesn't chop it up. It just helps to unravel them and change the conformation like we stated before.
And turn them off.
We need enzymes to come in to chop them up.
Yeah.
Okay? So, in the stomach, the concentration of hydrogen ions is greater than 100 millimolar, right? Which, like I said, in the blood, it's 0.00004 millimolar.
So, what's the pH of it then?
Between 2 to 3.
Okay. Yeah. So it's fairly low.
Yeah. Okay. And in the pancreas, some of the fluids that the pancreas releases, it's below 10 nanomolar.
So like between 8 and 10.
Correct.
pH. And that's to neutralize that acid coming into your intestines.
Exactly right. Okay.
All right. Before we move on, just quickly just tell the listeners, Mike.
Yeah.
What are the main reasons why we want to keep that pH at that 7.35, 7.45 range?
Well, because of, to be succinct, is to keep those proteins working happy, healthy, and efficiently.
If it goes out to that range, serious things will happen.
Yeah, so, but different proteins, different structures within the body will respond differently to depending on how drastic the changes are. So, for example, the proton pumps within our body. We know that nearly every single cell in the body has a proton pump to create a chemical gradient. Mm-hmm. And these chemical gradients, they'll either help the brain fire off or the heart to contract or whatever it may be. The activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump, its activity will fall by half if the pH shifts by one pH unit.
So this is a pump. This is a little bit of machinery on your cell membranes to keep the equilibrium or to keep the concentration of sodium and potassium in the right level.
That's right.
And so it's dependent on energy.
Yep.
So it pumps out generally 3 sodium goes out of the cell.
That's right.
2 potassium goes into the cell. This is happening all the time.
Oh, yeah. Without it, we'll be gone.
Okay. And you're saying if the pH does what?
Changes, shifts by one pH unit.
So what does that mean?
So let's say if it shifts from 7.5 down to 6.5.
Okay.
Your sodium potassium ATPase pumps, their activity will halve.
Okay.
Now, if we have a look at a very important enzyme called phosphofructokinase. Okay. Now, this is involved in getting energy from glucose, mm-hmm. right?
So a sugar, making an energy molecule from sugar.
That's right. Now, this is important to get all this ATP, all this energy from glucose, from sugar. If the pH drops by less than 0.1, so let's say it goes from 7.35 to 7.45, right?
Yeah.
Or 7.35 to 7.25, its activity will drop by 90%.
Wow.
So, and this is important to get energy. So the pH, again, so it depends on where we're looking at. But what we're trying to highlight here is that small changes in pH or small change, which are indicative of small changes in hydrogen ion concentrations, can result in drastic physiological consequences.
And therefore, we have these buffering systems in the body to stop
resist that.
Yep. Now, before we go on to what these buffers are,
yes,
let's just quickly tell the viewers, listeners, not really viewing, are they?
No.
Where are these acids coming from?
All right.
So my question to you, Mike.
Yes, Matt.
Where is the greatest source of acid in the body? So
in the body or coming from into the body?
No. Within the body.
What is the greatest producer of hydrogen ions within the body?
Yeah, more or less.
I would say carbon dioxide.
Wonderful. Excellent.
That's weird though. Like, from the outset.
CO2.
Yeah.
So carbon and 2 oxygen.
Mm. How does that produce hydrogen ion?
All right.
There's no H there.
So first of all,
it's
just
maths. Maths.
Just tell everyone, firstly,
yeah,
where carbon dioxide comes from.
Okay. You take a breath in, you bring in oxygen. That oxygen jumps into your blood and that oxygen travels to all the tissues of your body.
Yep.
The oxygen gets taken into the cells.
Yep.
Gets taken to the mitochondria.
With?
The mitochondria will use that oxygen and a little bit of other stuff. So, glucose, for example. Well, basically...
You make it sound like not important.
Well, it's pretty important.
A little bit of this glucose.
So, glucose plus oxygen...
Thank you.
...gives you 32 to 34 ATP molecules.
Okay.
But with a byproduct of carbon dioxide.
Okay, so that's the exhaust fume.
Basically, yeah.
So, they're like your little... production plants.
So now we've produced carbon dioxide, which then goes back into the blood.
Yeah, and so carbon dioxide, which I read this morning, is actually considered kind of a volatile acid.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you put CO2 as this volatile acid, or gas almost, out of your cell,
yeah,
the first thing it's probably going to hit is, what's 60-ish% of your body?
For me, muscle.
Okay.
Water.
Water, yeah. So that's again that boomerang.
Yeah.
So when you chuck CO2 with that boomerang, H2O, it's going to give you this long thing called H2CO3.
That's which carbonic is acid.
Carbonic acid.
But carbonic acid, it's in the name, acid. What does that tell you that carbonic acid is going to do since it's an acid? H2CO3.
Yeah, so
it's an acid.
So then, yeah, okay, Mike, I'll get it. It's going to be able to donate those hydrogen ions or protons.
So H2CO3 will donate a hydrogen ion.
So H plus.
So you minus one H from H2CO3.
Yep.
What are we going to have?
We'll just take it one H off. So we just HCO3.
But because we've taken a H off and taken a positive with it,
yep,
we're left with a negative with a HCO3. So it's HCO3 negative.
So that's the anion, right?
That's the anion. So carbon dioxide, CO2, plus water, H2O. You just do the maths, you add them together, gives you H2CO3.
So that's how you get your acid.
Yeah, that's carbonic acid. It hates itself because it's an acid, so it splits itself apart. It releases a hydrogen ion, and now you get H plus with HCO3 negative.
Okay.
So the H plus is that proton, the hydrogen ion that does all the damage,
yep.
And the HCO3 negative is what we call the conjugate base, and that's known as?
Bicarbonate.
Bicarbonate.
All right.
Very important physiologically.
So the take-home message here is... the greatest source of acids in your body is actually through metabolism and the production of CO2. Correct?
Correct.
And so when you are bumping up your metabolic rate or, you know, or need to produce more ATP, like exercising, you're going to be producing heaps more CO2.
Yeah.
Therefore, you're going to, in theory, kind of go more acidic.
Yeah.
Therefore, you need to get rid of that pretty quickly. Yep. Otherwise, you, as we said, you're going to die.
Preach it, Matty.
So, therefore, you need to get rid of it.
Yes.
So, I mean, as you all know, what happens when you exercise? One of the first things that happens, you breathe quicker.
That's right.
Okay. But let's pause there.
Pause.
Because I just want to talk about some other... ways of getting acid into your body.
Okay.
So that wasn't kind of an intrinsic way of getting acid.
Mm-hmm.
There are still other extrinsic methods.
Mm-hmm.
So like you ingest certain foods that will have capabilities of producing acid.
Can we preface this part of the conversation by saying that we're not talking about specifically eating or drinking acidic or basic foods?
Yeah.
Because that does not change the pH of your blood. However, if you ingest more proteins, for example,
certain types of proteins
that can produce more hydrogen ions.
Yep. So I believe
don't drink alkali water is basically what I'm saying, because it's not going to have any effect.
Okay.
By the time it hits your stomach, you got, like I said, a
pH
huge concentration.
One, 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
All right. So I read just recently also that. I think animal proteins give you a greater propensity of producing more acidics.
Why?
I think it's just the amino acids in the proteins. So, for instance, the amino acid cysteine has sulfur in it, and so that has the propensity to produce the acid sulfuric acid.
Yep.
Okay. Then you have phosphates.
Yeah.
Okay. And so this is not so much. Well, I guess phospholipids.
Yeah.
So cell membranes. So, whether it's plants or animals, phospholipids can be broken down into phosphoric acid.
Mm-hmm.
We've already spoken about hydrochloric acid. Another one, these two are probably more intrinsic, so like happen within the body, like CO2. We have something, if you exercise really vigorously,
yes,
and you don't get enough oxygen down to your cells, we go into what we call an anaerobic phase of metabolism.
What do we produce?
And we produce lactic acid or lactate.
Yes. Right?
And so lactic acid is... It doesn't have the glucose hasn't got the ability to go into the mitochondria. It just happens within the cell cytoplasm. And as a result, less ATP is produced, but we produce an acid.
Quickly.
Fair to say?
Well, yeah, we do produce ATP.
But not the same amount.
Correct.
And the other one, which is more of a pathology, is, well, not always, but generally it's associated with going into a different metabolic state where you don't have the abundance of carbohydrates and you go into the use of fats, and that's called ketogenesis.
That's right.
That produces acids
beta-hydroxybutyrate.
Yep.
Acetoacetate. And acetic acetone. Acid. And acetone, yeah.
And so that can be just in through normal diets or lack of carbohydrate in intake.
So I think if you do it through normal dietary means, you won't get the acidosis. You won't produce a sufficient amount of hydrogen ions to change your blood pH.
Okay.
But if you do it, but if it happens pathologically,
most commonly
diabetes, type 1 diabetics who either aren't managing their insulin or haven't taken any insulin or don't even know they're a diabetic yet.
Yeah. They're sick, just had surgery, their demand's gone up.
Because I think it's important that, as we know, we did a podcast talking about using...
We did diabetes.
Yeah, but we also spoke about using glucose as an energy source, fatty acids, glycerol as an energy source, and proteins as an energy source. That our body is going to be using glucose a lot of the time because that's what our brain wants and needs. And we will also be using fats to a degree and some proteins. But insulin is that key, is that trigger to tell us to start utilizing glucose, right? Mm. So it tells us to bring the glucose into the cells and start metabolizing it.
And I think it's also, it's anabolic, right? So it allows you to store fats and so forth easier. And so when you don't have that, you break down fats.
So with zero insulin in the body, that's when this ketogenesis really starts to kick in.
And then the take-home point is the ketoacidosis is an acid-forming state.
Yeah.
And then so people, let's say, with diabetes ketoacidosis, which is an acronym of DKA, can be quite devastating as well because their pH will drop, go towards the zero side, and they can be really sick. They can be altered levels of consciousness to in a coma to dying. So pretty serious. So they're the sources of acids. So we spoke about what an acid is, what a base is, what a buffer is, what's important to regulate in pH, and where you get the acids from.
Yeah.
Let's finally finish off, because I think we're going to run out of time today to talk about how we clinically test it, which is the ABGs. Mm. Let's just quickly talk about what are the different types, very briefly, different types of buffers in the body.
Yeah, okay. So you got extracellular and intracellular. It's probably good to state.
So within the cell or outside the cell? Okay, so let's just quickly knock off proteins. So as we spoke about kind of a bit earlier, proteins are just these complicated arrangements of amino acids. Now, in the amino acids, they have these structures. At one end, they've got an amino end, which is, what is it, CH3? CH4?
Yeah.
Ability to swing between a 3 and a 4. Is that right?
Yeah.
And at the other end, they've got a COOH. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. With the ability to go with the H or without the H. Now, each amino acid will have this joining to their next neighbor, next neighbor, next neighbor, next neighbor. Now, that means depending on what type of amino acid there are, and I believe there's 20. Is that right, Michael?
Yeah.
20 types of amino acids. Depending on the type of amino acids in these proteins would determine the capacity of the proteins to suck up hydrogen or donate hydrogen.
Yep.
So basically, you have proteins in your body, and what's the most, particularly the blood, what's the most abundant protein in your blood?
Albumin.
Oh, yeah, you're right. But one of the best ones that's soaking it up is hemoglobin.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's intracellular. Yeah, 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 absolutely.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. I mean, hemoglobin's in the red blood cell.
Yeah.
But its capacity of buffering is in the extracellular fluid.
So, yeah. Well, so the main intracellular buffers are proteins and phosphates. And hemoglobin is the main buffer within red blood cells. If you look at extracellular bicarbonate carbon dioxide system, which we'll talk about in a second. That's the most prominent, but plasma proteins such as albumin and inorganic phosphates are also buffers. Your bone also acts as a buffer because it can absorb hydrogen ions in exchange for sodium and potassium.
Phosphate, calcium.
Yeah, releases calcium, carbonate, phosphates, bicarbonate.
So why is that necessarily important to mention?
Because acid-base changes can also change your bone structure to a degree. Mm.
So if if your body's kind of trying to balance out or buffer an acidic environment for a long period of time, you might actually demineralize your bone, which makes it weaker, which may give you...
You can do the experiment. You can take chicken bone.
This is a really cool one. I did some work experience with an orthopedic surgeon, and we had a builder come in, and he broke his humerus.
Wasn't funny.
Wasn't funny at all. So it was his upper bone.
Oh, is that the humerus?
Well, not everyone's anatomist like you.
Okay.
So he broke that bone. Don't ask me how, but he broke it. And he came in. So it was set. He came in, I can't remember how long. Maybe, let's say, 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit more. 4 weeks later. Re-x-rayed. Hadn't healed at all. Not one bit.
Why?
So the surgeon said to him, Bob, builder... Do you drink Coke? And he said, no, of course not. I drink Pepsi. And so I looked at him and go, why are you asking that? And he said, well, in cola, I think colas, they have phosphoric acid.
Yeah.
And so that phosphate is sucking out of the bone. Yeah, yeah. So that's causing a buffering thing.
Yeah.
But it also pulls the phosphate, probably calcium, out of his bone. Mm. Therefore, he doesn't want that to happen because he's trying to heal.
Yeah.
So he can't heal.
That's interesting.
So they then said to him, you got to cut off, because he's having, you know, 6 cans a day.
Mm.
And he's like, oh, you need to stop that. Oh, so man. He's stopped, came back 6 weeks later, healed.
Wow.
So this just indicates phosphate.
Yeah.
So phosphate is a buffer.
Yeah.
Too much hydrogen, too much base plays around with that.
Yeah.
So it can fluctuate between a basic and an acidic state.
Right? So you can do a little experiment, which we do with our students, where you take some chicken bones and you bake them and you can put them in vinegar. And if you leave them in vinegar, which is an acid, for long enough, you take them out, the bones can bend like rubber. And the reason why is because you're taking out all the mineral deposits. So the bicarbonate and the phosphates and the carbonate and so forth, all of this.
So what does baking do? Does that cause...
So baking gets rid of the extracellular matrix. So the
collagen.
The collagen and so forth.
All right.
So one gets rid of the organics, one gets rid of the inorganics. Makes it brittle.
All right.
So it keeps it... So remember that the minerals harden the bone.
Yep,
and then you've got all the gels and fibers which sort of hold it together. So one...
Collagen.
Yeah. And so, if you put vinegar in, it's going to get rid of those minerals, demineralize the bone.
It makes it rubbery. So, is that... There's a disease like that, isn't it? Is it Paget's disease?
Maybe. Don't put me on the spot, Matthew.
All right. So, that's a good one. So, the first buffer that we'll just... We spoke about proteins already. So, proteins can be extracellular, intracellular.
Yeah, push that to the side.
Yeah, we've done that.
Let's talk about the main buffering system.
Wait. Phosphate, we just spoke about. Yeah. Phosphate can fluctuate from... It's acidic and it's more basic form. Is that right?
Yeah.
And what is the most common types of phosphates in the body?
Well, phosphate that's coming from ATP, for example.
Yeah, very good. So the form of phosphate is dihydrogen phosphate, which is H2PO4. Okay, and then it can swap into the a proton and then HPO. 4-2-.
Yeah, which is the major form.
And I think the most common ways you get the phosphate or the most abundant types of phosphates in the body is from ATP, adenosine
phosphate,
or glucose 1-phosphate, which is a energy byproduct of glucose, right? So that's the phosphate. So far we've got buffers of proteins, we've got the buffers of phosphates, and what's the big one?
The big one is the bicarbonate carbon dioxide buffering system. And this bicarbonate buffering system has bicarbonate involved, and that is the base, and carbon dioxide involved, and that is basically the acid, because we
basically
said, and so carbon dioxide, we know when it mixes with water, releases the hydrogen ions, like we stated before, so that's an acid, it's producing hydrogen ions, and the bicarbonate mops up the hydrogen ions. We didn't state that that equation that we spoke about before, which is the CO2 plus H2O, carbon dioxide plus water, gives carbonic acid, which is the H2CO3, which then splits off and releases hydrogen ions and bicarbonate, that's reversible. We didn't actually state that.
Oh, okay.
And because it's a buffer, it needs to be reversible, because if it wants to absorb or mop up hydrogen ions, it goes towards the direction of the CO2. And if it wants to produce more hydrogen ions, it goes towards the direction of the bicarbonate hydrogen ions end, right? So I always like to picture it sitting on like a little balance beam in which, depending on
what...
What
did you call that last time? Teeter-totter.
Teeter-totter. I think it's a teeter-totter in the States, isn't it? One person... A seesaw. It's a seesaw.
I prefer seesaw. I think most people would.
And so, depending on what's going on... So this is how I like to think about it. If, for example, you have too much or too many hydrogen ions in the body, it gets mopped up by the bicarbonate and pushes that equation in the direction of CO2 production. And so, what do? You start breathing heavily.
I thought you said... We're going to say turn into a dog.
Yeah, you turn into a dog and you breathe out all that CO2, because that's how you expel the acid, breathing out CO2.
Because carbon dioxide is the volatile acid.
That's right.
Whereas the hydrogen, and probably lesser degree, the carbonic acid is a fixed acid.
Yep, that's right. And so this carbonic acid or bicarbonate buffering system, you need to be aware of the bicarbonate that's involved, and the CO2 that's involved.
Okay.
So the bicarbonate is the base and the CO2 is the acid. Now, this is the major buffering system in the body.
Yep.
Okay. Now...
And it's just to recap, it's called the bicarbonate buffering system.
Bicarbonate buffering system. Sometimes you'll see it written as the bicarbonate carbon dioxide system.
Okay. All right.
Now, there's two major body systems that actually play around with hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions.
Okay. So just to pause for 1 second.
Which we've done many times, because you like to interrupt.
I always like pausing. So am I safe to assume...
Maybe
that,
not.
...that when your body is in this constant dynamic state of going between slightly...
Teeter-tottering.
Teeter-tottering. Depending on what you're eating, consuming, and... Depending on what your body's doing metabolically.
Yes. Metabolically.
And also, if there's disease states, etc., how much you exercise and all this kind of stuff.
All this stuff.
Is determining, you know, if your what buffering systems are working.
Absolutely.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay.
Your body's
And so maybe you could assume, I've got nothing to back this up, but you could assume maybe that when the system's a bit overwhelmed, let's say, then you need to bring in maybe these respiratory or the renal system to try and... Because the proteins, the phosphates, the intracellular buffer may be a bit overloaded.
Yeah, I mean, you can, if you bring it back to first principles and have a think about what happens. The thing... If we have too many hydrogen ions in the body...
Yeah.
It's constantly going to be buffered by bicarbonate, right? And so the bicarbonate will bind to the hydrogen and will ultimately produce CO2. And so you're going to have CO2, and that CO2 needs to be breathed out. Now, our stimulus for breathing, for ventilation, is CO2 levels, right? It's high CO2 levels, not low O2 levels.
Yep.
And it's because CO2 levels can change far more drastically because of the hydrogen ion concentration in the blood than O2 levels dropping. Because if I were to, for example, right now hold my breath, what's happening there is that the O2 that I've got in my bloodstream is going circulate. It's bound to hemoglobin. It's going around and
predominantly
98.5% of it's bound to hemoglobin.
The rest
is dissolved in the blood.
Yep.
As it's moving through the cardiovascular system, small amounts of O2 will be delivered to tissues. Not all of that O2 is going to disassociate, right, from the hemoglobin. So even though we like to say that the arterial system is oxygenated and the venous system isn't. It's not necessarily true. It's just a little bit less oxygen in the venous system, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So when you hold your breath and you don't bring any new O2 in, O2 is continually circulating and you're only giving off small amounts of O2 to the tissues because your body's actually quite good at saturating that hemoglobin. But what tends to build up far more quickly is the CO2.
Mm.
And so that CO2 that's building up then stimulates chemoreceptors. Do you know where some of these chemoreceptors are in the body?
Well, there's the peripheral ones and then the central ones. So yeah. I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the peripheral ones, they generally are more reacting to carbon dioxide.
Yep.
And that would be like aorta and the carotid body.
Yep.
And then you have the central ones, which are in medulla, which is right near your breathing center anyway.
Yep.
And that's CO2, but more hydrogen, right?
Yeah, it's both.
And so I think that's also what's in the CSF, so the cerebral spinal fluid, as well as what's crossing over from the blood.
Yes. So the stimulus to breathe is going to be that CO2, and it's because we need to get rid of the acid.
Yeah, it's pretty, why. Pretty sensitive stuff. So,
yes.
Then we can assume that if whatever's happening in your body is overloading all these buffering systems, then you might kick in to your breathing.
Mm.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'd say it. But the thing is, it doesn't...
Which is really playing around with the CO2.
And it might be... I don't want the listeners to think that the breathing mechanism is the last mechanism.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not as though it's going to use all these buffering systems and now it's overwhelmed, now we're going to be breathing like this. That's not necessarily the case. It doesn't take much for your breathing to kick in and control your carbon dioxide levels and hydrogen, and therefore hydrogen ion.
And I guess you, in a lower amount, you might even know that your respiratory rate's increased, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, think about it. 7.35, 7.45. Anything below 7.35, you should start probably worrying, right? You get to 7.2, you get acidosis. And that acidosis is just telling you got far too many hydrogen ions floating around in your bloodstream, and it can be dangerous.
Okay, so let's talk about that now, I think.
Well, let me first talk about the two major systems of the body that control the buffers.
Yep.
Okay, so like I said, the main thing we want to focus on here is CO2 and hydrogen ions and bicarbonate. They're the major things. Now, the CO2 and hydrogen ions are quite synonymous because if you've got more CO2, you got more hydrogen ions, right?
Okay.
And then the bicarbonate is going to be the conjugate base that can mop up the hydrogen. So, to make things simple, if you have high CO2 or high hydrogen ions, you're going to be closer to being in a state of acidosis.
Mm.
If you have low levels of carbon dioxide, low levels of hydrogen ions, closer to a state of alkalosis, right? So alkalinity is the same as base, basically.
And I think, just to confuse the listeners here...
Which you've already done.
I do that a lot. You can actually be... Because there's a difference between acidosis and acidemia.
Absolutely.
And so...
Acidemia is referring specifically to blood. What's going on in the blood. Yeah. That's right.
And so I think that's more likely to be a constant... in that one case, whereas an acidotic, you could be maybe have a degree of acidosis somewhere and a degree of alkalosis somewhere else.
Mm.
But the collective amount, so it could be mixed, but the collective amount in the blood can only be one.
That's right. And
so when we're doing an ABG, which we'll do next podcast we're actually looking at what that state is. So if you've got an acidosis that's in your blood, so it's more like anemia really, right?
Mm.
Or alkalosis or anemia, and whether it's... Which you're going to talk about now, is it's coming from the respiratory or...
Yeah. So if you're looking at, basically, if you're looking at the hydrogen ions going up and the carbon dioxide going up, acidosis, like I said, if they go too low, it's going to be alkalosis. When you look at the bicarbonate, if the bicarbonate goes too high, alkalosis, because the base is going up, or if the bicarbonate goes too low, acidosis. So that's important for the listeners to be aware of, because basically...
So there's really only four states if out of whack.
Yeah, basically. And so listeners need to be aware that this is pretty much what's going to happen. Now, the thing is that the body can control carbon dioxide, hydrogen ions, and bicarbonate through different mechanisms.
Yeah.
And it's mainly through two major body systems, which is the respiratory system and the renal system, right?
Okay.
Now, the respiratory we sort of touched upon because through gas exchange, we get rid of carbon dioxide. Mm. So if I hold my breath, I increase carbon dioxide, which means I increase the acid.
Yep.
So... if I don't have enough hydrogen ions, what do you think I could do? hold my breath. Mm. If I have too many hydrogen ions, I start breathing faster and get rid of, wash out that CO2. Mm. So there's that. So that's how the respiratory system controls acid base, through CO2 explicitly.
And because it's a fixed system, it can only really do, like your lungs as a collective, two lungs as a collective can only really play around with the speed, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe the depth and speed.
Yeah, that's right.
Whereas the second system you're going to now can probably fine tune it a bit more.
Yeah, we often say that the respiratory system is an acute means, short term means for changing blood pH.
So what does that mean? Like minutes? Minutes? Like really seconds, minutes?
Seconds.
Second, minutes, hours.
Yeah.
Playing around with the acute level.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Whereas now moving down to the kidney.
Which we haven't stated. The renal system is now the second system that can control blood pH.
And that's both levels of hydrogen and bicarbonate.
Yeah. So we know from our previous podcasts, we spoke about where hydrogen ions can get reabsorbed and excreted, for example, in the kidneys, and where this happens for bicarbonate.
Yeah.
And so basically when we look at the renal system, we stated that at the proximal convoluted tubule, that's where we reabsorb, so that means throw back into our body, back into our blood, 85% of the filtered bicarbonate. Mm-hmm. And so we spoke about carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, right? We spoke about the diuretic. The diuretic, yep. And that it inhibits, so this is like acetazolamide, and this inhibits this bicarbonate reabsorption happening at that tubule. So this can, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, okay. So at the distal tubule, we excrete bicarbonate ions, so that's where we pee it out. So this is how our kidneys can control our blood pH, by reabsorbing bicarbonate if we need to become more basic, or expelling hydrogen ions.
And remember, that's what I spoke about in terms of when I climbed Mount Everest.
Oh, that's right.
Less oxygen up there, breathing quicker. As I breathe in more, I'm not only getting more oxygen, but I'm dispelling or getting rid of CO2.
Yes.
So if I'm getting rid of my CO2, that
more
means
basic.
That means I'm actually losing my hydrogen indirectly, which makes me more basic. That means my kidneys need to do what?
Excrete more bicarbonate.
Right, which I did because I kept on had to go to the toilet and pee.
Yes, yes. All right, so now, shall we talk about the different states in which the body can be in? So because...
Yep. So I think...
You can have acidosis or alkalosis, but it can be due either to respiratory means.
Yep.
Which basically means you either have too much CO2 or not enough CO2. That's basically respiratory acidosis, too much CO2.
Yeah.
Respiratory alkalosis, not enough CO2. And then you can have metabolic acidosis, which is
bicarbonate driven.
And a bit of hydrogen
ions. In terms of bicarbonate levels. So, basically, when we do our ABG next week, our blood gas, we're going to go through this systematically.
Mm.
But, essentially, the take-home message is, if you have an acidotic or an alkalotic state, and you want to see if it's coming from the respiratory system, you're purely looking at CO2.
Yeah.
But if you want to see if it's metabolic, whether it's an acidosis, first you've got to know the pH. Mm. And then if you've established it's a pH issue and you think it might be a metabolic cause, then you're purely looking at bicarbonate.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so when we look at metabolic acidosis, so this is going to be, like you said, it could be due to decreased urinary secretion of hydrogen ions.
Yeah,
so you're holding on to too many.
That's right. It could be what are we doing? Acidosis?
Metabolic acidosis.
Okay, so it's metabolic, so it's within the body, outside the respiratory.
Yeah. So should we go one by one and start with the respiratory? We've done it.
Yeah, sure. Let's start respiratory.
Okay.
I think it's easier to get the head around.
All right. Let's start first, respiratory acidosis. So two words in there.
The first point I'll just make before we go into the particular diseases, I think the real essential take-home message is whether it's a respiratory acidosis, so pH too low, or a respiratory alkalosis, pH too high, we know it's coming from the lungs. It's simply either you're breathing too quick, which is going to be alkalosis, because you've lost too much CO2, or you're breathing too slow, like you said, holding your breath. So you have all your conditions, which are causing by hypoventilation, or, on the other end, you have all these conditions that are causing hyperventilation.
Mm. So it's basically you know it's respiratory based, and it may not just be air into the alveoli and air out of the alveoli. Right. It could also be ventilation perfusion, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So it could be a ventilation or respiration. Remember, ventilation is air in and out of the lungs, and respiration is gas exchange at the tissue.
Yep.
So some of the, like you said, some of the basic causes for respiratory acidosis.
So could start with acidosis?
Yep.
Okay. So this is essentially too much CO2.
That's right. And some of the causes could be decreased alveolar ventilation. So that means there's not enough air going in and out of the alveoli.
Okay.
That makes sense, because that means CO2 can't get released and it's stuck in the blood.
Yeah, and one of the most common causes of that is?
Drugs? Drug overdose? Drug? No? I know drugs definitely...
If you're down at the alveoli level and it's just an exchange issue...
Oh, no, I'm not talking about saying, I'm talking about ventilation. I'm talking about air getting in and out of the alveoli. From the atmosphere, air coming out from the environment into the alveoli and coming back out. So you've got decreased alveolar ventilation.
Okay, so let's start with just moving through the exchange out in. Mm. I mean, like the most obvious would be if you're doing acidosis, we're retaining CO2 or our breathing rate's hypoventilation, so not enough to what it should be.
Yeah.
Start with what drives the speed of your breathing.
Okay, so are we going to start centrally and move outwards?
Yeah, so brainstem, or the respiratory center in your brainstem, which dictates the speed.
So medulla and pons are basically respiratory control centers.
There's a depression there.
Okay.
So it's being depressed.
Yeah.
And so some common things would be...
drugs.
Yeah, like opioids.
Yeah.
Or anesthesia.
Yes.
Okay. Or too much alcohol. Okay.
So I wouldn't know.
Or brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. Sedatives. That kind of stuff.
Okay.
And then before we go down into the tract, let's have a look at what else you need to have a good breathing.
So you need the musculoskeletal system.
Yep. So you need to have nerves going down to the muscles to tell them to work.
Yeah.
And so if you have neurological problems. So
it could be a peripheral nervous system issue.
Yep. So you might have...
nerve damage.
Yep. So I think it's Guillain-Barre syndrome.
Yeah, Guillain-Barre syndrome.
Or you might have spinal cord injury if it's really high up above.
Yep.
Or you have phrenic nerve, which innervates the diaphragm.
Some lesions somewhere.
Myasthenia gravis.
Yeah.
Good. And then you go into the wall itself, so that could be more anatomical. So people can have... Broken ribs.
Or polio, maybe not here in Australia, but polio, they had to go into the iron lung because of the fact it's a musculoskeletal disorder.
Yeah.
They couldn't get that... breathing happening appropriately.
Severe scoliosis.
So scoliosis and kyphosis and lordosis, they're all basically structural issues with the spine.
Yep, vertebra. Lordosis, I can't think of having a big impact on it, but scoliosis, probably kyphosis could.
Yeah, maybe not lordosis, because that's just basically like a hunch. But scoliosis is an S-bend, lateral S-bend of the spine. And that's going to alter where the ribs sit into the spine and where those ribs then articulate with the musculature.
And how well it can expand.
Yeah.
Another big one is obesity.
So, really?
Yeah, because you have an increased intra-abdominal pressure, which restricts the lungs expanding.
Well, there you go. So these are all... issues in all of these systems or areas can result in hypoventilation, which is decreased air in and out of the lungs.
Essentially, yep.
Okay.
And then you go into the lung itself. So this is intrinsic lung issues. So you might have problems with the lung expanding. So these are restrictive diseases.
Okay.
Like sarcoidosis.
Sarcoidosis, yeah.
And then you go down to what you're saying in terms of patent airways. So this is probably...
pulmonary edema as well, by the way.
Yeah, so that's probably gas exchange.
Oh, yeah, we'll talk about that in a sec, yeah.
And then you go to, chronic obstructive pulmonary diseases.
Yes, so that's going to be, asthma, chronic bronchitis, emphysema. These are narrowed or blocked airways. So it could be blocked due to mucus, or it's narrowed, like in asthma, because the smooth muscle's constricting air, can't get in and out. Or it could be due to emphysema, for example, where the alveoli walls start to disintegrate and you don't have an appropriate surface for gas exchange to occur. Yeah.
Or pneumonia, where you've got a lot of, pus or fluid extradate from that infection.
And it's important to say that if you do have some sort of pulmonary edema, what's happening there is that the increased fluid is at the respiratory membrane. And gases want to move across the thinnest membrane possible. If you've got a fluid there, that's a thicker medium to get through, right? And so that alters the ability for the gases to diffuse through.
Yeah.
Great. So these are the major... major causes,
categories
yeah. of respiratory acidosis.
Yeah. And that's all driven by, all that is essentially hypoventilation.
Yeah. And I think we did that well, don't you think?
Well, I thought we kind of did, but
yeah,
who knows? Now well, we move to the opposite, which is the respiratory alkalosis.
Yeah.
So this is the opposite. You're breathing too quick.
Yeah.
You're getting CO2 out too much.
Yeah.
So think about it.
CO2 washout, we sometimes call.
When have you seen someone who is breathing really quick?
When they're hyperventilating.
Yeah. And so that's brilliant. So
thank you. I love it when you commend me on knowing what I should know for my job.
A condition that causes a person to hyperventilate.
Yes.
Tell me.
Anytime you see me come into work, you get anxious.
Mm.
And this anxiety forces, every time I walk past your office door, you're breathing into a brown paper bag.
I think that now you get confused with me vomiting. So, which surprisingly, if yeah. I keep doing that, would cause me to have acid-based problem if I keep vomiting.
Of course, we'll talk about that shortly because that's metabolic.
Very good.
So, respiratory alkalosis, anxiety can cause somebody to hyperventilate,
yep.
and that's breathing too quickly, which means you wash out all the CO2. If you wash it all out, it's not in your blood, which means there's no hydrogen ions being made, which means you've got a mismatch between hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions, and you're alkalitic.
Yep.
And you have alkalosis. Can we just quickly, I think it's important to say, when somebody hyperventilates and they pass out, that's got to do with the fact that carbon dioxide and oxygen play around with the diameter of the cerebral vasculature. And when you have not enough CO2, your cerebral blood vessels tend to constrict.
Okay.
And the blood going to your brain reduces and you pass out. Okay? So that's why when somebody is hyperventilating, to stop them from passing out, they give them a brown paper bag. It doesn't have to be brown. It's just a bag to breathe into because they're recycling
generally
the
not
CO2.
Plastic. I think that's the point.
Yeah. So I mean, Matt paper. Has handed me a plastic bag to breathe into, but
I was just trying to suffocate.
And you breathe in and out of that because you're reintroducing the CO2 back into your body
so
to maintain
it.
Levels.
Which, you know, in the clinic, you will have some oxygen masks that are rebreathers. So you are recycling the air that's going out.
Makes sense. There's so many studies coming out about giving patients O2. We'll talk about that another time.
Yeah, I think so.
So
anything else that might cause a person to breathe quick, like pain, if a person's in a lot of pain, they will breathe more rapidly and that could cause a pH issue. Other thing, going back to drugs, so certain drugs like salicylates.
Like aspirin. Yeah, salicylic acid, aspirin.
Yep. Obviously, if
I don't know why. Do you know why? Why aspirin intoxication can cause this?
No.
Yeah, we probably should have investigated that. Hypoxia, so up on top of a mountain, like you stated before. Yeah.
That was last summer when I was on the North Face.
I was wondering why you don't have any of your toes left.
Yeah.
Your feet look like the bottom of an elephant's leg.
They do have toenails.
Yeah, you've got toenails, but you've got no toes.
All right. Other things are infections. So you have a fever or you've got some kind of inflammation on board. You could cause an increase in breathing. Probably, I think you spoke about chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, but I think also acute asthma can cause an increased breathing.
Mm-hmm.
That could
the short, sharp, shallow breaths.
Yeah.
But if you do it enough, it will wash out CO2.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, I think
so. That's respiratory done.
I think that's respiratory. So I don't think there's much else we've kind of missed, is there?
No. Are we talking about compensation today? Compensatory?
No. That's next week.
Okay.
Or next podcast.
So let's now talk about metabolic acidosis.
So now we go away from the lungs, but we still are looking at what would cause a state. We'll start with acidosis. What would cause a state of increased hydrogen ions?
So it's basically the addition of
a decrease in bicarbonate.
Yeah. So it's basically an addition of acids. Other than carbon dioxide, right?
Yeah.
And bicarbonate and carbonic acid, sorry. It's acids, an addition of those of acids outside of CO2 and carbonic acid. Or the removal of bases.
Yep.
Right?
So you've either got something on board like we spoke about earlier which would cause that addition of acid. So we said certain things like lactic acid, diabetes ketoacidosis.
Yep. So shock can put somebody into lactic acidosis.
And then you could just lose a lot of bicarbonate. How do you lose your bicarbonate?
If, like Matthew, you decide to travel overseas and you tend to eat off the street and you're not used to eating off the street.
When he says eat off the street, that doesn't mean literally eating off the pavement.
Well, that photograph that your wife sent me would say otherwise.
Okay, I dropped that raw tea parcel.
Severe vomiting and diarrhea.
I don't think so much vomiting, I think it's more diarrhea.
Vomiting, absolutely.
No, but vomiting, you're going to be losing acid.
Yeah.
Right? Not so much bicarbonate.
Oh, sorry, of course. I'm thinking alkalosis. Yeah, absolutely. So, diarrhea. Diarrhea. Because you're losing a bunch of electrolytes through that.
Which actually I did develop from my trip to India, and I ended up in hospital in Singapore.
Yes.
I'm not sure what my pH was. I didn't take it. But I did pass out.
Ah, well, that's that's your vasovagal syncope.
No. Well, that's another separate thing altogether.
We should talk about that. Maybe not your specific case of vasovagal. Every time you spew, you pass out.
Loss of bicarbonate ions can be caused by diarrhea.
Yes, okay. Severe.
Or maybe
takes a fair bit.
Renal issues.
So, decreased urinary secretion of hydrogen ions.
Or increased. Did you say increased?
No, we're talking about acidosis. So, it's a decreased secretion of hydrogen ions. So, you're holding on to too many hydrogen ions.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yes.
Yeah.
Or loss of too many bicarbonates.
So, which is renal failure. Yeah. So, renal failure can lead to metabolic acidosis.
All right.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
Now, what's happening to the partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the blood here? I know we're going to talk about it when we do ABGs next week, but we spoke about respiratory acidosis, respiratory alkalosis, and we said CO2 levels are changing.
Yeah.
Do you see CO2 levels changing at baseline for metabolic acidosis and metabolic alkalosis? Or can you see no changes in CO2?
Well, I think we'll really get into that next podcast, but essentially I think you'll start to see changes with the lungs trying to compensate.
Yeah, but at baseline you don't really see CO2 changes. Because the causes are not CO2 driven.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I think that's what you're saying.
We'll talk about it next week.
Another big one is lactic acid.
Yeah.
So this is where you exercise very vigorously.
I don't think you can exercise enough to get into metabolic acidosis. You can't get into, as far as I'm aware, you can't get into metabolic acidosis through exercise. It has to be through something like shock or injury.
Well, I'll tell you a quick story.
Is it boring or is it interesting?
I don't think it was. I had in my health science degree, the health science diploma, I had it wasn't a professor, but the academic, he was a sports scientist,
okay.
And he did a lot of work with cyclists.
Yeah.
And he said to me, it was his anecdotal, he said to me that the toughest sportsman that he's worked with, a cyclist, to push themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And he said... he was in the lab doing the VO2 max,
yep.
Where they have the mask on and all that stuff. And he was kind of trying to motivate this particular cyclist.
And push him to extremes.
Yell at him, swear at him, do all that kind of stuff.
Smack him in the back of the head. Kick him.
Call him, names.
Yeah.
And he was...
So basically, every day I come to work with you.
And so he was pushing him pretty hard. Yeah. And I think he was like getting to his max.
Yeah.
And there was a knock on the door. And... the scientist, the academic, went to the door and just said, look, I've got a thing on. Walked back and the guy had fallen off the bike.
Yeah.
And he had passed out.
Yeah.
From presumably this as an issue.
Oh, so they didn't test his blood pH.
I don't think he did.
I don't reckon. Look, he may have been on the cusp of pushing under 7.35, but I really can't see exercise pushing somebody to metabolic acidosis. It won't be maintained. Lactic acid doesn't stay around very long in the body. It goes back to glucose substrate.
That'd be interesting. Let's put that out to the listeners. Prove me wrong.
I'm always happy to be proved wrong, as long as it's not by Matt. I think that the majority of the time that you get lactic acidosis is due to shock.
All right. There you go, listeners. There's your job. Prove Michael wrong.
Prove me wrong. Good luck.
And then you'll get a special gift if you do. By me.
Okay, I was going to say, you can purchase the gift.
All right.
Is it an audio book?
No.
Is it a song? Is it a song that you wrote specifically about anatomy and physiology?
That's
it's still on the wraps.
Anyway, so we've got lactic acid, we've got loss of bicarbonate through my trip to India,
yeah.
And we've got also ketoacidosis, which we spoke about as maybe in diabetes, but some people may get it if they starve, in starvation.
Yeah.
I think you would if you were in the...
I think you'd have other issues before you get acidotic.
You're a skeptic to acidosis,
aren't you? No. Well, no, I just think that when you're truly kicking into ketoacidosis, you've got to have zero insulin in the body, right? You've got to have no insulin. If you even have the smallest amount of carbohydrates and a functioning pancreas, you're going to release insulin and you're not going to be in acidosis. As far as I'm aware, I think...
But isn't also ketogenesis also incumbent upon how much the liver...
Ketogenesis, yes, but not ketoacidosis. So you can go into ketogenesis on minimal carbohydrates. So you can still eat carbohydrates and go into ketogenesis. Mm. But becoming ketoacidotic, I think you need to have huge amounts of ketone bodies, and this needs to be due to zero insulin.
Okay.
All fat producing ketone bodies. That's right. And again, prove me wrong, please. I may be partially incorrect there.
I think he's going to be. So thanks, listeners. Thanks for proving me wrong. Now, the final other thing that is commonly causing an acidotic state metabolically is the ingestion of some. I guess they could be toxic.
Like what?
Alcohol.
Oh yeah.
Ethanol, methanol.
Or causing metabolic acidosis. Yeah, what's the mechanism there?
Of it, maybe whether it's an acid in itself, I'm not sure.
Nah.
What's methanol? As in, like, what's its pH?
No idea, but... Really? I didn't know that.
Hmm.
Are you sure that's just not due to its subsequent renal failure and liver failure? What's the
byproduct, the breakdown product of ethanol?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I don't know.
So what's your liver make it into?
I should probably know this. What do you think it is? Of ethanol? Are you saying ethanol or methanol?
Let's go ethanol.
Alright, because I know methanol is not going to be a good one. I know that you got an enzyme, alcohol dehydrogenase, and it transforms ethanol into acetaldehyde.
So that would be acid producing?
Yeah, I think it is actually. Because it can... Yes, because acetaldehyde turns into acetate. And yes, okay. That makes sense.
What were you saying to me earlier?
I was saying how much I respect you as a fellow academic.
So, methanol, ethanol, ethylene glycol.
That sounded like a little poem.
Yeah. Actually, it was. I got it from another.
Ethanol, methanol, ethylene glycol. Can it all turn into acetate?
And is that what you breathe off when you go over the limit?
It's acetone.
Acetone. Is it? So, when you breathe in the breathalyzer?
Yeah.
What is that actually measuring?
It's not. It's acetate, and acetone is a very similar structure, which is what. So when you're breathing in the breathalyzer and you breathe out the acetate and it goes beep and it picks up. Let's just say you're also a diabetic who hasn't taken your insulin and you're functioning off ketone bodies, which is acetic acid or acetone. Mm-hmm. You're breathing that out, and that also tests positive on the breathalyzer.
Okay. So and it has a distinct smell to it too.
Yes, that's right. All right. Was there others?
All right. Yep. The final one is the metabolic alkalosis.
Yes.
So this is where you would have too much bicarbonate in the system.
Mm-hmm.
So in your arterial blood glass, which we'll do next week, you've got too much bicarbonate on board, or you've lost excessive amounts of hydrogen. And so this could be from the other end of food poisoning or a bout of... vomiting.
It's vomiting. So. Loss of hydrogen ions through vomiting, because obviously heaps in your guts.
Yep. Or you could have it through the use of diuretics, which you spoke about. You're losing too much.
And what about like sodium bicarbonate therapies, like intravenous sodium bicarbonate? You could infuse too much.
And I think excessive amounts of antacids, like... do you take antacids at all?
I have been known to dabble in the antacid. In the bicarbonate, if I have too many spicy foods, maybe I'll take an antacid, which is basically bicarbonate.
Yeah, so
you're gonna take a fair bit though, man.
Okay.
Because again, the bicarbonate itself is going to be buffered. So if you're healthy, you don't have an underlying pathology, and you're not putting a huge amount in, I can't see how it's going to.
All right.
Drastically
affect. I think that's everything.
Was there anything else you want to talk about? Man, I tell you what.
It's over an hour.
Is are our listeners going to email me and correct me on a whole bunch of stuff?
I hope they do. I hope they cite a whole lot of papers and say, you know, Michael, here's an example of strenuous exercise causing lactic acidosis.
And also the whole acetone-acetate relationship there. Mm. Alcohol. Prove me. Talk. You know, give me some
ethanol, methanol, ethylene, glycol.
Or do they all produce acetate?
Or they all produce an acid forming.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
I think that's it.
So next week, next podcast, which will be next week, we're going to talk about ABGs, which is arterial blood gases, which as medicos or aspiring medicos, what are you going to do? You're going to measure. You're going to take some arterial blood.
Not venous. Not venous.
I didn't say that.
Michael.
You can take venous blood and measure these things, but they're not as accurate. You can take some arterial blood and look at the arterial blood gases. That's partial pressure of CO2 and O2, and you can look at bicarbonate, and you can look at sodium. You can look at a whole bunch of stuff. You look at sodium ions through arterial blood. It's not part of the ABG.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about ABG.
No. It's not part of the ABG. But ABG is including what we spoke about today with some other things.
Yep. So I think that's a long session for the
day. I know. Hopefully, everyone has paid attention. I'm sorry for talking about numbers and the amount of zeros at the beginning of this podcast. But I think it's important you understand what pH means. Again, if you want to contact us, we've got Twitter. We've got Instagram. We've actually got Facebook. We didn't talk about Facebook. Come follow us and join us on Facebook. That's where you can post some questions. The Facebook page is Dr. Matt and Dr. Mark's Medical Podcast. Easy. Mm. Our Instagram is at the handle GU Biosciences, all lowercase. Find us. Our Twitter handle is GU Biosciences. And you can send us an email with any topics you want us to cover or to tell me how wrong I am or give me some more info. I mean, Matt's obviously always wrong, but I'm wrong part of the time, and I like to be corrected. So send me an email, gubiosciences@gmail.com. Thanks, everyone.
That's great, Mike. Thank you. And I will see you all for the second part of our acid and base next podcast. I don't want to say next week.
It'll be next week.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, mate.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.